So in effect, there's penalties for half the hospitals.
Yeah, that's like No Child Left Behind. Everybody has to be above average.
That's what we all say about our kids. Leanne, are you on the line? Do you want to speak to this?
Yes, I try to, hi, this is Leanne Han, CMS. I try to wait until I hear more about other people, what other people think. And Elizabeth is right, and when we submit the mismeasure to NQF, we were thinking that we submitting the measure for NQF to endorse our methodology. And for the IQR, the public reporting, as Elizabeth explained, that we use that methodology confidence interval. And for COPD, I don't think that CMS has decided whether and how we're going to use the COPD measures for value-based purchasing or for payment purpose yet. So, and then the payment methodology, CMS will publish the rule this year. We haven't made the rule yet. How are we going to calculate the payment method? And I believe what you are referring to is what the law says in the Affordable Care Act. But what I'm trying to say is that we come to NQF and ask for endorsement of the methodology, and we have not decided how we're going to use these measures, or whether we're going to use this measure. But the intention is to use it for public reporting so far.
Steve Grossbart here, and this is really a point of clarification for the NQF staff. Whether or not CMS has determined how to use the methodology, the act of endorsement by the NQF is basically we're as a committee and ultimately the NQF membership are saying that this measure is appropriate for accountability and public reporting and value-based purchasing. Is that correct?
Well, certainly for accountability and public reporting have been are sort of the watchwords, and those encompass any number of things, including payment incentives and the like. So that's exactly right. NQF's endorsement really includes assessment of the measure, how well it performs, how well it can provide valid and reliable information about performance. How any particular entity, such as CMS or anyone else, might use that in any kind of particular programs, whether it's public reporting or payment or whatever, is a little beyond the actual endorsement of the measure. Though that line is a bit fuzzy because there are implications for how the methodology can produce information and the kinds of information that could potentially be used in any number of ways.
But if it's not endorsed, I thought my understanding was it would be more difficult for CMS to use it for accountability in public reporting or value-based.
So Leanne, did you want to comment?
But I saw the question is about, the threshold, the benchmark, the confidence interval, to exactly how CMS is going to determine. I don't think we have any decision made about that yet. And also, I don't think we come here to propose that method and ask for endorsement. So I need NQF to clarify that, too.
No, and that's what I just said.
Yeah.
That's what I just said. I mean, we don't know that. But Steve, to your question is, CMS does look to NQF for our process to evaluate the measures and grant the endorsement. And so it's been a good relationship going forward. And so if there are issues and concerns about the measure that make people uncomfortable about potential endorsement, I think we want to raise them. I think we want to discuss them, give CMS an opportunity to respond to them, things like that. Any other questions, Dr. Edelman, Dr. Grossbart, any of the other committee members? Christine or Dion, did you have any questions about this? I think the acceptability of outcome measures out in the field has grown tremendously in the last several years. I think a lot of the initial anxieties around them are lessened, though outcome measures are more challenging. They are methodologically more complex.
Now, I'd just like to say one thing, and I take CMS's point of view, and I understand our job is really a technical job. But I, for this measure, for mortality, I really think ambient levels of particulate pollution are potentially important, and I think the methodology exists and the data exists for that to be tested.
Okay. And I think that message has been, you know, relayed to the developers for their consideration. Anyone else on the work group? Any other comments for this measure?
This
before we move on?
I don't have any comments. This is Dion.
Okay. All right. Then let's move on to the next measure on our agenda. This is measure 179. And this is a measure that is primarily used in home health care around improvement in dyspnea. And this is the percentage of home health episodes of care during which the patient became less short of breath or dyspneic. This is an outcome measure. Christine, did you want to kind of share your thoughts? Christine, did I lose you?
I apologize. I had you on mute. So that
okay.
You all missed my brilliant thoughts. But let me start with a disclaimer since I don't have a clinical background. Is it dyspnea?
How
do I pronounce it? Okay. So thank you. So I looked through this one, and so the information that we have indicates that there have been improvements in the measure over time. It looks like this was first approved by NQF back in 2009. However, the information that we have doesn't tell us what those improvements are. So perhaps after I finish, we might be able to get that information at a later date. It suggests, because there is the suggestion that the agencies are improving care, I guess it perhaps is related to this now being a publicly reported measure. But we don't have those specific details, nor how many patients are in the affected population, although there is information in the submission that does suggest that a large percentage of certified home health agencies are, in fact, reporting this information. There does seem to be a significant performance gap. I guess they're at 62% of patients that are showing improvement upon discharge. There does seem to be room for improvement. In terms of evidence, there is some evidence, but none of it being specific studies that does support home healthcare interventions for patients with COPD. And I think that was sort of the highlights. Unless anyone had any questions or anything else to add, those were things that I had been looking through the submission.
This is Dion Chul. I guess this is probably for the measure developers if they're on the phone. Which patients are we talking about? Any home health care patient with any diagnosis?
Do we have any?
This is Deborah Deeds from APT and working on the CMS team. Is that, can you hear me okay?
Yes, thank you.
Sure. This is for all Medicare and Medicaid patients who we have not restricted them by condition. It's based on the information that's collected via the OASIS assessment, and it's all adult non-maternity Medicare and Medicaid patients who mm-hmm. are receiving skilled services.
And then until they are discharged.
Yes, it measures their level of dyspnea at the time of admission and their level of dyspnea at the time of discharge and compares them.
This is Norm Edelman. Dyspnea is kind of like the opposite end of the extreme from death. It's a very subjective, difficult to measure symptom. And I guess this shows my ignorance in knowing how to use this tool. I could not find the specific tool that was to be used to measure dyspnea and the assessment of how reliable it is. There's a recent review of dyspnea in one of the lung journals pointing out that it's an exceedingly difficult thing to measure.
I'll tell you that the OASIS assessment asks the clinician to measure and report whether or not the patient is having dyspnea with minimal exertion and describes what that is, with moderate exertion, which is walking distances less than 20 feet and a few other things, and also when walking more than 20 feet. So
is that a questionnaire, or is the patient actually exercised?
This is the guidance for clinicians, is that this is to be evaluated by observing the patient.
By exercising the patient, is that correct?
Yes.
Or is it just guessing what that might be?
It is supposed to be administered by actually seeing what the patient does in their home.
I missed the testing of the reliability and the validity. But is this a reliable test?
Hello, this is Gene Nuccio from the University of Colorado. When we developed the original instrument for OASIS, we did field testing of the reliability of that instrument. And I believe that information was sent to NQF, the data that we had for that. Let me go back to your previous question regarding the scale that is used. It is it's a behaviorally benchmarked scale, a five-point scale, where the patient is, in fact, observed walking around or moving around in their home in his or her home environment. So it is based on observational data that's taken at either start of care or resumption of care. The behaviorally benchmarked options are fairly precise in terms of, for example, moderate exertion is described and checked with, you know, while dressing, while using a commode or bedpan, or walking a distance less than 20 feet, so that there are benchmarks that are on the item itself that the nurse is using, and there's also a guidance manual that goes into additional detail. Regarding the validity and reliability of that instrument, the using the standard scale for reliability, it was judged to be either very good or excellent in terms of its reliability in the field testing. We've not changed the item since the field testing that went on back in about 1999-2000.
And I'm correct that all of this information is kept electronically, and therefore that's how it's all captured. But that, I think on page 14 you discuss how you have you go out and audit the information to ensure that it is accurate.
Currently what happens is a Medicare or state surveyors will go out and check the patient records for documentation within the assessment notes, and to make sure that those corroborate the scoring on the assessment, OASIS assessment instrument itself. So that's sort of an ongoing thing. What I was referring to was the base was back at the very beginning of when the item was developed. And again, I emphasize that the item has not been changed since the time of that analysis. Our records, the data show from three different assessments that we were in, we had highly reliable results.
Great. Thank you.
Steve Grossberg here. I have a question. This is not truly, although the data is available electronically, that's because the home care agency enters it into the OASIS database manually. I mean, so this is really not data that's collected directly during the delivery of care. It's the billing process, isn't it?
It is the data are collected at a visit that typically lasts about 2 hours or so at the start of the care or the resumption of the care. So it is the initial clinical assessment of the patient, and then the information at the other end of our care episode is based on a discharge survey, again using the same item, and again the same home visit to the patient.
But there's no formal electronic health or e-specification around this measure.
I'm afraid I don't understand what your question is.
The data is not flowing from an electronic health record into OASIS. It's flowing from data collected from the medical record. Am I missing something? I mean, is that
the OASIS instrument or assessment instrument is either a paper and pencil or an electronic based assessment tool that the nurse or the physical therapist would go out to
they
start
complete
here.
They complete the OASIS form in the presence of the patient. Okay.
It's not a data extraction, if that's what you're asking.
Yes, that's helpful.
Yes, the survey that occurs of the agency is a comparison between the medical record of the patient and the data presented using OASIS.
But this is an additional step to the care delivery process as opposed to an electronic health record where data is collected during the process of delivering care and then used for reporting. And what I'm really trying to get through is there going to be a time when the measure is no longer a regulatory burden but rather is collected during the process of care and then used for regulatory reporting? This is an add-on step. I mean, the home health agencies would not have an OASIS tool if it was not mandated for conditions of participation.
The OASIS is actually integrated into, that's part of the requirement, is that it's actually integrated into their assessment process so that they don't ask they don't do their own assessment of dyspnea. It's part of the care planning process.
That's helpful.
This is Dion Jewell, and I'm looking on page 11, which I realize the measure developers can see. But are there really 83 risk factors in your risk adjustment model?
Yes, there are.
Holy cow.
We do our data model, our risk adjustment model makes use of. Items from the OASIS instrument, other items from the OASIS instrument. It does not use demographic information such as race or SES. It does make use of age. The number of variables is slightly inflated in that to ensure that we account for the fact that our scales are ordinal, not interval. We dichotomize each level of each scale.
Right, okay.
So that a scale that has five options, ends up with five, an item that has five options, behavioral options to evaluate, ends up with five variables, and that's why we end up with such a large number of variables.
Okay, looking at number thinking. Okay. But that makes more sense.
So can I follow up to that?
Absolutely.
So you've got 83 variables. How many classifications or categories does that truly represent? So as you said,
it would probably represent about 4 or 5 classifications. There'd be functional. There'd be we have a set of diagnostic groups that are used, and then we have physiological and psychological characteristics also.
And I apologize, I didn't have a chance to, I realize a lot of this is online as to the detail, and I didn't have a chance to go and investigate all of this, but given the very low R-squared that you're reporting, is there any thought to, or maybe you've done this and it didn't pan out to be anything, but really looking at stratification or sub-analyses of some of these subgroups, either diagnostically or otherwise?
I think we have looked at various stratifications. The intent has always been to report the value for in a collective kind of model, because many of our agencies have a small number of patients. If you then end up with a stratification situation, then you end up having many agencies for whom you can't provide some information.
Okay.
And the model, the R squared, while it is pretty low, is still probably better than many of the other publicly reported measures in other settings. So.
Okay. Thanks.
Any other thoughts or questions from the workgroup members for this measure? All right, then I guess we can move on to the next one. The next two measures are from NCQA. The first one, 549, is pharmacotherapy management of COPD exacerbations. Dr. Grossbart, I think this is yours.
Thank you. So this measure looks at patients 40 years and older during a calendar year who the numerator being an acute exacerbation of COPD and who were discharged and dispensed medication, so the patient needs to fill the prescription. The denominator is any COPD patient in that age group who's been discharged from an acute care or inpatient setting. The impact is relatively high. The developer makes a compelling case for the importance of the significant impact in the population costs and so on. I didn't see quite as robust assessment of the performance gap. The evidence cited, very similar to measure 102, I believe that I've got my numbers right, but the question I have is the developer rated the evidence quality high, and I didn't see that the evidence was significantly different from the evidence that was rated moderate by a different developer for a similar measure. So I thought that the evidence is not as robust as the developer has stated. Reliability and validity. It was not the most robust discussion, I'd like some clarification about from the developer. I'm just looking through the testing results and the reliability and validity of the data. I had trouble interpreting. Stepping through my list, in terms of usability, this measure has been used by the NCQA for some time. I think some of the usability issues that I found, it's calendar year data, and it's health plan specific rather than patient specific. I didn't see a strong sense of how this data is being used for quality improvement, or if through all the years of collection quality has improved. Then finally, moving on to feasibility, it's a mix of data types. Let me give you a page number. I'm sorry, I haven't cited page numbers. So page 17, a mix of data generated by healthcare personnel, but coded secondarily through claims. There's no e-specifications. This is not being driven off the electronic health record where appropriate. There is some advantages to having the claims data, such as filled prescriptions as opposed to, you know, the provider provided a prescription. There's, you know, through the claims process, it's the reliability of the data is not as robust as if it was coming from an electronic health record. And that's my summary.
Great. Comments from the other work group members? All right, let's see if we've got the measure developer on the line. Is anybody from NCQA on the line? Operator, would you check and see if anybody from NCQA is on the public line, perhaps? I think we're looking for Ben Hamlin.
Yeah, hi, Reba. Ben, can you hear me?
Yep, got you now.
Okay. Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, great. Did you hear Steve's comments?
I did. The performance improvement component or the gap issue, we have seen, we stratify this by different product lines and by the two medications in particular. We have seen an increase in performance. We have seen a slight variation decrease over the multiple years of data collection, although there still is, if you look at the quintile information that's on pages 14 and 15 for the different product lines from 2010, you know, 2008 to 2010, it goes back a little further, but we usually give the last 3 years worth of data. You will see a slight narrowing for most of these, where there is some leveling, but again, it's you know, there's considerable variation in both the means and in the percentiles. So we feel that it is still a measure that has some way to go. We're looking for, again, follow up. Following exacerbations, the discharge-based measure, so it's sort of a member discharge-based measure and not a patient-specific. This is a measure that we have also seen a decrease in the populations, eligible population size over the years, so even though the rates are increasing, it's a proxy for how well the plans are managing people with COPD to prevent exacerbations. And we have seen a decrease in the population number of discharges overall, so we also feel that that's an improvement in the measure performance, even though it's not reflected directly through the rates. As far as the e-measure specification, all of our e-measure work right now is being driven through our meaningful use project, so we're not co-developing e-measure specifications for any of our measures at this time. I believe the other measure is currently being developed in our meaningful use. This one is not at the moment.
Dave, did he cover all your questions?
Yes. The only other question I have, and this may not be appropriate time, is: are we going to be doing the side by side of the similar measures?
Yeah. Yes. We've got several in this project. We've got several in the asthma group as well. we've prepared the side-by-sides that I think you've seen in your SharePoint files. What we like to do is do the first initial evaluation of all the measures, because if perhaps there is a significant problem with a measure that you don't want to recommend it, then we don't need to even, you know, put that into the mix of comparisons. So that's why we want to do the first go-through of all the measures on their own. And then, absolutely, it will be a very important part of our meeting and discussion will be to put these very similar measures side by side and ask the question, you know, do they all add value? Do they work together? Do we need them all?
Thank you.
Important conversation on related and competing measures.
Right. I think some of the misalignment areas are in the age ranges where, you know, we're at 40 and I believe the other measures are at 18. Again, since we're getting this out of, you know, purely administrative claims, we've been testing the things like concomitant diagnosis of asthma and COPD, and we found, you know, there's more noise below the age of 40, and so that's kind of where we've decided to start that threshold. You know, other, I'm trying to think of some of the other differences. I can't pull them up the top of my head, but that's sort of why I think there may be some variation because of the setting for the accountability that we use these measures for.
Okay. Anything else, Steve? Any of the other work group members?
Nope.
No? Okay. All right. Then we can move to our last measure, which is also from NCQA, and we're going to go back to where we started, which is spirometry testing again. And this is measure 577, use of spirometry testing in the assessment and diagnosis of COPD. The percentage of members age 40 years and older with a new diagnosis of COPD or newly active COPD who received appropriate spirometry testing to confirm the diagnosis. And Deanne, I think we're back to you.
Yes, I'm the bookend today. So as Reva just described, this measure is specified differently from the first measure I reviewed in two important ways. One is the lower end of the age range, which is 40 as compared to 18 in the prior measure. And the other is that this measure is more clearly specified to address confirmation of new diagnosis or newly active COPD, which is much more consistent from an interpretation standpoint with the guidelines. As compared to the previous discussion that we had. There's clearly plenty of evidence, I think we can all agree, and I don't know that anybody's going to debate this, but the impact, again, is high. And to a point that was made earlier, both the impact in terms of confirmation of appropriate diagnosis, not underdiagnosing and not overdiagnosing, but appropriate diagnosis. The issue related to performance gap, the results are actually later on in the document. For those of you that were reading it, it's not contained in the first section of the document. But it's clear that at the health plan level, there's quite a variety of performance of this measure. So I think the case has been made there. The issue related to disparities, the NCQA has made the case that the measure is not currently configured to detect that and that it's burdensome to be able to do that at this point in time. And so one of my questions to the measure developers is this issue of how you're looking to deal with this going forward, given that the published evidence is pretty clear about the presence of disparities in this area. Reliability and validity data are presented. The reliability is high. This has been used for some time now in the HEDIS system, so there's a good data set there to evaluate reliability. The validity presentation, I was a little confused by the, I'm trying to find the page number here, by the title above, by the labels ahead of the actual data, because it talked about numerator results, but I was under the impression that these were rates, so I was confused by that. But they're broken out by plan level, and again, there's a reasonable range between the 10th percentile and the 90th percentile. If I'm understanding these data appropriately, it looks like there's a lot of room for improvement given that at the 90th percentile we're at 52% in the commercial area, but I'll take clarification on that if I need it. The usability and feasibility issues, I think, are pretty similar to what was just identified in the prior measure. You know, this is a plan-level measure, or at least it looks like it could be used at other levels, but in this particular system, it's the plan level with the HEDIS system. I'm not clear what kind of improvement has been generated over time, given that it's been in play for a little while. So that same question there. And other than that, I didn't really have any other thoughts.
Okay, so this is Ben again. I can, to the last question first, we have noticed a modest improvement over time, not nearly what we would have expected. You know, as you noticed, the rates even across the highest quintile, they're fairly low, and so we would like to see, you know, better improvement there. To address the disparities issue, this is actually true across all of our measures in the HEDIS health plan populations. We continually test the availability of appropriate race, ethnicity, SES data in these large data sets, and the variability is so high such that in some plans have 98% complete data, other plans have zero because they actively do not collect this information for either legal or ethical or just, you know, business model ideas. NCQA is working very hard right now to specify what disparities data should be collected, and we're going to recommend that. We've also worked with CMS on the e-measure side for the recent blueprint update on, you know, what information should be collected in EHRs as far as race and ethnicity and SES and so on and so forth. And there's a move now towards standardization, but until it's mandated, we don't expect to be able to reliably collect and report out that data and stratify our measures in that regard. We're hoping that it will come soon, but since it's all voluntary right now and there's still some issues around the reliability of the data collection, depending on who's collecting the data and how it's being presented in the administrative claims or even in the EMR environment, we're not ready to release a measure that is stratified, you know, holding people accountable for those disparities.
That addresses my questions. I don't know if other folks have questions or thoughts about the measure.
Minor question. Under net benefit, the proposal indicates that it promotes smoking cessation, administration of influenza and pneumococcal vaccines. I wasn't aware of that. Do you have data that show that?
No, not directly, no. We have part of our work.
I'm pretty sure smoking cessation is wrong. I'm not sure about the others.
Okay. Yeah, I think the idea here was that during the assessment process, you know, ensuring that vaccinations that are recommended in the guidelines that help lead to improved outcomes in COPD management might include conversations around smoking cessation, ensuring that you know, pneumococcal and influenza vaccines have been given in the appropriate time frames, obviously, you know, for flu, you know, annually.
I understand the idea, but I think literature don't show that takes place.
Yes, well, we actually have several measures that are trying to address those specific issues, and we're trying to fold them into a composite for COPD. Unfortunately, most of those, you know, even the flu vaccines and the pneumococcal vaccines are not really well represented in claims data. So we're looking at alternative methods for incorporating those into a more comprehensive COPD composite.
Any other comments? This is Reva. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, this is Deanna. I realize we'll, you know, talk more in the steering committee about the side-by-side comparisons, but I have to say that this measure strikes me as considerably cleaner than the prior measure, from the standpoint that it really is specific to the place where we know the guidelines are clear about the usefulness of spirometry, number one, which is the confirmation of the diagnosis. And not a more abstract sort of notion of when you might use it. And number two, I really don't see the value added of having the age range to 18 when the average age is in the 50s. And even if you drop it below that, you're talking in the mid-40s. I worry that that encourages overutilization. So I'm open-minded to be convinced otherwise, but those are, you know, that's, when I put them side by side, those are the things that stick out in my mind.
This is Christine. Can I, before we move on, just ask one question about the denominator? The members required to be continuously enrolled for 2.5 or 2 years, and that I just questioned whether there is a concern that that will be a hurdle, particularly, I think, for the Medicaid population, since many members in Medicaid plans do not necessarily have continuous enrollment. You know, that it may, if you've sort of tested to see if that is going to be a challenge, that 2 year continuous enrollment.
So yes, it is a challenge. It's not a barrier, however. Our Medicaid continuous enrollment criteria has a lot more of the guidance around inclusion of gaps in those coverages, understanding how the Medicaid population generally works. You know, we want to ensure that the plan has data on this person for the appropriate amount of time, and given we need to have sort of the negative diagnosis history and you know, for the ensuring the new diagnosis, we want to, you know, we don't want to hold them accountable for something where they just, if someone switched, they didn't have the data, but so that's not really a new diagnosis, and we want to avoid the overutilization component. You know, so again, we always look at that, but yeah, it is probably, it does limit the denominator population a little bit in the fact that, you know, there is not a lot of people, or there's probably a fair proportion of people who may get eliminated because they may not have meet that longer term enrollment criteria. Mm-hmm. The Medicaid population is also smaller because of the 40 and older, and in our duals, we generally default to Medicare, I think, for our dual eligible. So it's a pretty small population to begin with, I think.
Okay. Anything else from other work group members? All right, Mrs. Reeve, I had one question for you, Ben. You listed that the level of analysis for this measure is potentially at the clinician, group practice, or individual level, as well as plan level. Are you aware of this measure being used at clinical group levels, and have you tested the measure at clinician or group levels?
We're aware of it being used at the clinician level. We don't have any testing data for that right now, though. So this measure is in fairly broad use. We only regularly collect the HEDIS data collection, which is what we provided you. But we, you know, we feel it's relevant to at the provider level as well for ensuring a new diagnosis.
All right. Okay. I think that gets us through all the measures that are on our agenda today. Thanks to everybody for focusing the conversation so we get through in a timely fashion. Essentially, what we're going to do is summarize your work, your discussion points, your ratings for the entire committee's discussion at the March meeting. As lead discussants, we will be asking you again at the meeting to introduce the measure and go through the criteria as you've done today, highlighting the issues and focusing in on the areas where there have been raised some concerns or questions. If based on the discussion today you want to change some of the ratings you may have submitted, contact Katie or Jessica and they'll help you do that. We can certainly arrange that. This effort to try and go through these measures in a preliminary fashion is really meant to share the work kind of thing and to be able to make our meeting agenda for the in-person meeting to be efficient and so we can get through the entire group of measures. Are there any questions from the work group in terms of preparing for the in-person meeting, the work you've done today, and what we're going to be doing at the meeting?
Well, what will take place between now and the meeting?
I think essentially not a great deal if you've already had a chance to go through all of this information. I know some of your colleagues and some of the other groups are kind of still working through some of the measures. We will provide you with the summaries, and that will give you a chance to review what was discussed today. You'll have the summaries from the other work groups, and you'll see what the reviews were on the other measures, and give you a chance to prepare yourself for the discussions, as well as specifically prepare yourself to lead the discussion for the measures assigned to you.
Is Katie there with you, Reba?
Yes, she is.
Hey, Katie, it's Dionne. I have the spreadsheet because that you sent out, so I will just amend my comments for the PCPI measure and email it back to you so that you have it.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Any other questions from the work group? All right, then, operator, could we open the lines for any audience members to see if there's any public comment?
All lines are open at this time.
Right. Does anybody want to make a comment, question? Going once, going twice. All right. It doesn't appear that there is any comment. Any last chance questions from the work group? Then I thank you all very much for the work you've been doing, the evaluation, the thoughtfulness. I know the time that you've invested in this is not insignificant. We will be in touch with you as we get everything organized for the in-person meeting. For the work group members, if there's absolutely anything, any questions, concerns, or issues that you have, please don't hesitate to contact any of us. That's what we're here for, and we're happy to help. And I really do look forward to meeting in person and getting to know you better at our in-person meeting. But I really am very thankful for the work that you've done and for today's discussions. I think they've been very helpful and very thoughtful. With that, unless there are any last-minute comments, we've got a few extra minutes for your day.
Hey, thanks.
All right, then.
Thank you.
To everybody.